We've been privileged the past week and a half to really have profiles and courage in this city. And I've been privileged to be able to talk about it on this show. Starting from last Monday, 50th anniversary of the Hungarian Revolution, talking to people who were there. As many of you know, the Institute for Public Affairs of Montreal, which I run, held a conference this week on questions of values. How do we as a society, as a civil society, respond to the Islamist challenge? Not in geopolitical or military terms. Inside, where do we find courage? And in every encounter, it's not always about the big stories or the big speakers that impresses and leaves a lasting mark. And leaves a lasting mark not only on yourself and your soul, but on your society and your community. It's the people you meet who find courage from what you're showing them. Samuel Johnson, the great British author, once said, "All we have to warm ourselves with in the winter of our lives is the integrity of our ideas, the passion of our living. Everyone dies. Very few people live. And whether it's in private affairs or in public affairs, you can't sweep passion under the rug. Without it, we're nothing. Our little houses, our little families, our little lives mean nothing without the signature that we can leave on a society." And Samuel Johnson ended his soliloquy by saying, "The reason the only thing we can depend on, and the reason the things we have to look up to, are our personal passions and our public courage, is that faith can be fleeting, families can be fickle, and friendships can be feeble." After the conference last week, I was approached by a remarkable young man. He's an ex-soldier, finishing his degree right now here. He'll be serving, hopefully soon, in the military reserves. And he wanted to do a simple act of courage and passion and conscience. He wanted Montrealers to show support for our soldiers. He didn't want to debate the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, or anything else. But last Saturday, the normal coalition of deniers and defeatists and protectors of every failed culture's right to be wrong were marching again in the streets of Montreal, reminiscent of what happened August the 6th in the famous Hezbollah rally. And this young man asked the Institute for help in getting out the word to make a little rally on Saturday morning to support our troops. It was last minute. Everybody arrived at their various corners. The rain was furious. It sliced our faces like icicles off a roof ledge. But there we stood, our little group, and this young man had made up these wonderful signs, "Support our troops, stand with the free." And as we stood there and car after car honked their approval, the other side also started to show up. Numbers diminished because of the weather. But finally, there was a statement, a personal statement. It's probably the most dramatic thing, more dramatic than conferences and colloquiums. The statement of free citizens standing on a corner and speaking and demonstrating fidelity to a just cause. And it's not just words. A just cause is real. We know what it is. It's simple decency. We feel it in our gut, and we feel it when we betray it. And it's my privilege tonight to have that young man on with us to discuss another initiative that will be starting, and we're proud to help him with it. David Zand, welcome.
Hi, Beryl. How are you?
What got you angry to do the first demonstration?
Well, I've been following these demos for the past couple of years, and I find that you actually have to go down and see them, because the media, the mainstream media, is not doing a good job of accurately portraying what's going on at these demos. And there's actually a lot of hate there. And I'm not saying that everyone is like that, but there's a lot of movements there that really don't stand for Canadian values. And you can just do the simple test of reading their signs. Saturday we were witness to signs that said 9/11 is an inside job, and support the resistance in Afghanistan. And I don't think this is what you would call a peace movement, as the mainstream press calls it.
No, it's sort of like my constant question to Jack Layton when they talk about the resistance in Afghanistan, when he wants to talk to the Taliban. My rhetorical question is, Jack, what do you want to talk to them about, whether they'll shoot you as a socialist or cut your throat as a trade unionist? David, we just got to pay a bill. We'll be right back.
Sure.
And you can email us with your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. And it's our pleasure to be talking with David Zand, young man, former soldier, who started something called the Montreal Alliance to support our troops. And David, before the break, you were telling us how tired you were of both the media perverting the message and just the ugliness of the signs of the numerous protests we've had in Montreal over the summer, but supporting the resistance and supporting the Taliban and all this stuff that led you to do this first rally. David?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah.
I was mentioning that, and I think there's a lot of us who are frustrated, who are angry, and who really want to express ourselves and our appreciation for the troops who are out there. And even though this conflict is far away, the people are within our hearts, are close to us, and when we really have to be out there on the street to show them that we support them, it really means a lot to them. I know when I served as a soldier that being away from home and family and everyone, that it was very important to me to know that back home there were people who were supporting me. And one of the things that touched me the most wasn't the gifts and the things like that we got from the military. It was a letter from school children saying how relieved they were and how happy they were that we were doing this.
You mentioned the media before. Does it frustrate you sometimes when the demonstrations of the naysayers are relatively small, the media will blow up the numbers and puff it up to much more than it was? Why do you think they do that?
I don't know, but they're doing a terrible job, and it's an injustice to our society and to everything the media is supposed to do. They're supposed to inquire. They're supposed to report the truth, but they have some kind of bias. I don't know what it is, and they're not doing their job.
Now, before we get to your next project, which I'll talk about in a moment, I wanted to get to your reaction. I spoke about this last night, talking about media bias. When we were out there that Saturday morning, a reporter came over from a Francophone radio station, and we were talking, and you had me talk to that reporter. How taken aback were you by that last question she asked after all the discussion, and then she just threw a question at me, "Are you a Jew?" What did that say to you? I saw your head swivel, almost as if somebody had struck you.
I mean, it was a little bit of a shock, but it wasn't a surprise either. I know they think it in their heads, but I didn't think that they would openly ask that kind of question. I mean, to think that individuals could just get together and support something without being part of a group or some kind of conspiracy.
And this wasn't even about Israel or the Middle East or anything.
No, I mean, I my sign just said, support our troops, not the enemy. How can you disagree with that? I know there's a certain part of Canadian society, unfortunately, that supports the enemy and not the troops.
And I wasn't even holding a sign. I was just talking to her about the General Afghanistan mission.
And the other sign said, we stand with the free. And there were people who came up to me saying things about Harper and things about the war in Afghanistan. And my message is that we stand with the troops, and for some people it's very difficult to support our military.
Now, for a lot of people who don't know, this was, this was the first demonstration in Montreal of any large city in Canada in support of our troops. Many of you have heard that Red Fridays are being held across Canada, where people get together in downtown areas. They wear some red as a sign of support for our troops. Montreal has not had any of it. And David, the next thing that you're planning and that I'm proud to help you with is that this Friday, between 1 to 2, at Place de Canada, we're having what?
We're going to have a demonstration in support of our troops. And I'd like everyone to come down just for an hour, take your lunch break at that time, wear red, yellow ribbons, whatever you like, bring your Canadian flags, let's show some patriotism, support for our troops. Hopefully we'll have some good weather, I'll get some good pictures, and we'll send that out to our troops in Afghanistan.
And all we're asking for is a half hour of people's time.
Sure. If you want more information, you can contact me at montrealalliance@gmail.com.
Yes, that's one important. Word. There's Montreal Alliance, one word, montrealalliance@gmail.com.
Yeah.
David Zand, thank you very much, and thank you for your courage.
Beryl, I thank you many times over.
Pleasure.
Bye.
Let's go to the lines. Dino.
Yeah, how you doing tonight?
Good, you?
Excellent. I've been listening to your show for the past couple of nights, the station and your show in particular. I just want to say to David, what he's doing is great. It's excellent, you know, and most people do support the troops. But just because, let's say, people aren't really pro this war in Afghanistan doesn't mean they're against the troops, you know. I had two grandfathers, and four uncles that fought in World War II as brave vets, and I'm very patriotic.
Right.
But I don't like Stephen Harper. I don't like George W. Bush. And really, this 9/11 thing could have been prevented. He had like 4 months or 5 months, and they were warned that this is something like this is going to happen. They did drop the ball.
Well, there were warnings through the 90s. Clinton, instead of indicting bin Laden in 98, had a chance to wipe out their whole training camps, but he didn't. But they had no idea of where it was going to be. You can't blame the victim for the actions of the aggressors.
I saw the Clinton documentary, and there was a couple of times that they could have taken Osama bin Laden out.
Yeah, you know, Dino, we had this might interest you. We had a fellow named Andrew McCarthy. He's often on the show, and he's a remarkable writer. And you can see his stuff on National Review online. But he was a former prosecutor in New York, and he was one of the senior prosecutors with Rudy Giuliani when Giuliani was going through some of his most famous cases. But one case that McCarthy was given was the 98 indictment against bin Laden. And he's just written an article that where he said his greatest frustration was because the Americans simply decided to indict bin Laden under American law. American law demands discovery. That means the prosecution has to give to the opposition all the information they have on him. And bin Laden's cohorts, which included some of the blind sheikh and some of the others involved in the 93 bombing, had top flight lawyers and had to be given the information the prosecutors actually had. So not only did Clinton not move militarily, he really fumbled the ball in terms of the justice system.
Actually, yeah, I've heard about that. I know what you're talking about. But also, before Clinton left power, he also warned George W. Bush that Osama bin Laden is the number one guy.
That he did.
You got to get him. That's one thing I find with the radio. I find that you sort of sugarcoat one side and you don't really.
I don't sugarcoat, Dino. But I'll tell you this: there are, and we're running up against the clock. But I appreciate your point. But I sugarcoat the side that says we have to depend on the kindness of strangers, on the kindness of those guys over there, or morally relative thinkers. Remember, America is hamstrung by one thing, which a lot of people forget. A lot of people have said we didn't need to go to war in Iraq. We could have taken Saddam Hussein out clinically. Executive Order 1343, signed by President Gerald Ford in 1976. This allowed the CIA or any American intelligence outfit from targeting assassinations. They've tried to overturn that executive order in Congress 13 times, and 13 times has been defeated.
So that's
a big, big problem in American policy. Dino, I thank you for listening. I hope you continue to piacere in Buenos Aires.
Okay. Take care. Good night.
We'll be right back. And one of the great storehouses of reason and sanity in North America is Victor Davis Hanson, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, writes for the National Review, considerable number of books that he's written. I'm not even going to name them. I would recommend to everybody, go to his website, victorhanson.com or NRO. Victor, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
How did it go this afternoon, by the way?
Very good.
Okay. Victor, you and I have talked about many things in foreign policy and domestic policy, but we're days away from the midterm elections, and I was very taken by an article you wrote recently called Liberals Gone Wild. The traditional thinking is the Republicans, the war, Bush's inability to sell certain messages to certain audiences are going to drive a lot of people in the Democratic column, may result in a loss of one of the houses of Congress, and yet you bring up a very interesting point. Why are the Liberals shrieking so much? If they're supposed to have the Republicans on the ropes, why are they getting so rabidly shrieky these days? What do you think is driving them so crazy?
I think they understand that their core message, first trimester abortion, gay marriage, UN sovereignty, high taxes, entitlement spending, we all know what it is, quotas and affirmative action, open borders, amnesty, really doesn't get you 51%. So they have to play this stealth game they do every election where they either count on a Watergate or nominate somebody like Kerry, Dukakis, Mondale. They lose, and they know that. So what they get hysterical, and you see that they can't really run a campaign and keep their mouth shut, because as soon as people start paying attention to them, we get today John Kerry, and this is sort of Pavlovian with them.
Yes.
They just can't repress this ideology that distrusts the military, hates George Bush, hysterical. And we've seen it now with Jay Rockefeller, who said Iraq was better off under Saddam. We saw it with Ted Kennedy, that we were worse than Saddam at Abu Ghraib, Dick Durbin. There's a whole litany of this.
When I hear Ted Kennedy mouth things like that, and I remember his brother, who said, every man's pain diminishes me, and called for America to come out of the Eisenhower era and be involved in people's struggles for redemptive change, and to see where the liberals, even smaller liberals, have come in 40 years into this isolationist corner. It's a remarkable reversion.
It is. It is. It's almost as if once the civil rights agenda was enacted, once we had workers' compensation, once we had minimum wage, once we had all of these necessary programs, they sort of said, well, now that we have equal opportunity, we have to have equal quality by result. And they wanted to.
In other words, not just equality, but parity.
Parity by result, and government fiat. And everybody said, wait a minute, I don't want to go there.
And I don't want the government, I don't want the government in my pants all over the place.
Exactly. And they get angry and frustrated because this utopian vision doesn't appeal to a majority of the citizens. Maybe 40%, but not 51% unless they have a scandal or unless they have a hysterical outburst. Or, and you see this frustration. It's sort of a knowledge. It's like an addict that knows that his drug is killing him, but he also wants to get free of it.
And I think
ideology is not going to win it for him.
I think we're maybe starting to see that reflection even in Canada. Of course, we elected a new government this year, and part of the promise of that government is to roll back statocratic interference in our lives. It'll need a majority to do that, but I think Americans are getting, who are never that keen on state interference in their lives. The liberals, the smaller liberals, have no agenda. We're having a liberal leadership race in Canada, and they're just falling all over themselves without policies. But when we come back after this break, I want to talk to you about some new attitudes, both in Canada and the States, about the war, which the Democrats were heavily counting on, and maybe it just isn't there. Montreal will be right back with Victor Davis Hanson right after this. And we're back in discussion with Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, and it's always a pleasure to talk with Victor. And today we're talking about domestic issues rather than foreign issues. We've been talking about the midterm elections that are coming up next Tuesday. And, Victor, before the break, you were making the point that the liberals are going a little crazy right now because the statocratic agenda that they've had doesn't leave them very much room for maneuver. So they were counting, the question I wanted to pose to you before, they were counting on the polarization of opinion about the war. But there have been, not that I'm a big believer in polls, but there have been a couple of polls in the States and in Canada that shows a shift toward support for the effort, the strategic effort, if not the tactical effort. So are the Democrats really going to be able to play this as an anti-war election?
No, because they haven't been able to offer any alternative. I don't think, one thing you got to remember, if you read all of the critiques that the Democrats have made, are popular authors like Fiasco or Kovachu. Who are the villains? Tommy Franks, Paul Bremer, General Sanchez. They're all gone. And who are the heroes of all of these critiques? General Petraeus, he's going back there. General Casey, he's there. Ambassador Khalilzad, he's there. H.R. McMaster, colonel, expert on counterinsurgency, he's there. So there's not much they're going to do differently than we're doing now unless they want to just give up. And I think everybody understands it. The last time the United States did that, 1975, we had the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, we had the Iranian hostage taking, the Cambodia Holocaust, the Central American communist insurgency, and we had just a disaster in the military morale. So they don't have any choices.
I think there's a general impression out there that now that we live in a non-bipolar world and with one great power, that somehow this Pax Americana is sort of a Pax Romana, when perhaps it is truly a Pax Libertà, but that message is not getting across.
It is not. And I think the Democrats have a classic dilemma of not having any responsibility of governance, so they can just get these cocktail hour, boutique, faculty lounge, library carol announcements from on high, but everybody in America is starting to worry that, wait, we're mad about Bush, we're mad about this, but these guys, this is sort of utopian, nightmarish, I should say, to think of Pelosi and Dingell and Rangel and all these people making serious policy for the United States. It's precisely because it is a unipolar world, and everybody from those in the Aegean to the Horn of Africa to China, the Sea of Japan, they depend on the United States, but they don't want to depend on those people. They have no track record of responsibility.
We've talked in the past, and we certainly agree that the kind of statocratic engineering we've seen from let's call them small-L liberal governments has now begun to choke the life out of every society, and not just on fiscal issues, not just on tax rates that are killing the working class more than anybody else, but all the rule and regulation over nothing that the state shouldn't be involved in because they're not addressing the real issues that the government should be addressing, and leave the rest to the people and leave some room for self-reliance. Yes, it is. Absolutely. But my question to you is this. As much as we don't like the state engineers of the left, is there a danger that we've got a swing on domestic issues to moral legislators of the right?
I'm not a practicing fundamentalist Christian, so I would probably be a good person to ask about that. There's this moral equivalence that these fundamentalists or the bogeymen that are just morally equivalent to the Islamists, but I really don't see them as a powerful force. If you look at what...
I want to draw an equivalence to the guys on the left who've been interfering in our lives so much to perfect the human being. Is there a right wing that could get too much power that will put all kinds of moral legislation and moral strictures
so.
On...
I think that we have two moral forces. We have a religious moral force on the right, the Christian fundamentalists, and we have a secular utopian moral force on the left, atheistic. And I think that force hampers democratic candidates and gives them much tighter parameters in which they can operate within than the religious, so-called religious right, because we've got paleocons, we've got neocons, we've got libertarians. And so I really don't see them as exercising a veto power on mainstream Democratic Party. And the problem we're having in contemporary postmodern Western civilization, if you look at Europe as an example of where we're going, is that when you create a statist, top-heavy government, no defense, falling demography, rising rates of illegitimacy, no marriage, unassimilated minorities, you just have a spiritual deadness. And look at Europe. People live for the moment. They don't believe in transcendence. They don't believe in a soul. They don't believe they should have to defend themselves. They think freedom is an entitlement. And the whole society is imploding. And I think that's sort of what the Democrats wanted for us. And so Europe's the canary in the mine.
The canary in the mine.
Yeah,
and that's why I'm telling everybody, go to the private papers of Victor Davis Hanson, victorhanson.com. Vic, thanks very, very much for being with us tonight and taking the time.
Thank you. Always
a pleasure.
Yes.
Montreal, we'll be right back. God, it feels good to have an evening of straight talk and guts. And we've got it in Canada as well. Before I introduce our next guest, who's here with us for the first time, I usually take something out of what somebody wrote, the body of it. But in this case, we go right to the end because this is the essence of it, and this is the essence of what Canadians have to understand about the bills of goods that we've been sold for many years, about our place in the world. In September, Senator Romeo Dallaire told the Senate Committee on Darfur, either we stay at home, shut our face, and stop expounding how great a people we are, or in fact shift to becoming a great nation and build the capability, end quote. The author goes on, it's time to talk about building capability. Otherwise, we should shut our face. Wonderfully refreshing, non-politically correct, non-salon liberal chattering class, and I'm happy to have its author with us. John Turley Ewart is deputy comment editor of the National Post, and God knows what we do in this country without the National Post. John, congratulations on this piece.
Thank you very much.
I
really was inspired to write this by a piece that I saw in the Toronto Star, authored in part by Alan Rock, suggesting that we Canadians could do something in Darfur. He listed five things that we could do. The primary one is provide protection. Several months ago, Erwin Kotler, former Minister of Justice and Liberal Cabinet Minister, wrote a piece suggesting 10 things that we could do to help the people in Darfur. And again, providing protection was another a top thing. My main point is I think these politicians are being dishonest with us.
I think they're being hopelessly dishonest. You know, we organized the first demonstrations, and there were ecumenical demonstrations of that, on Darfur in 2004. When I say we, people of the Institute, together with religious leaders in the city, and then we attended others. And all we were asking for in 2004, the spring of 2004, before 400,000 people were killed, before as many as 2.5 million were displaced, was for our government, the government of Erwin Kotler, the foreign minister of Ministry of Pierre Pettigrew, to simply forget about troops, call it what it was, a genocide, and we got no, no, and no.
Exactly. And I think the reason you got no, no, no is because it put them in a position of having to face the fact that we can't do anything to stop genocide. And that's the unfortunate truth that Canada has to face. We have cut our military to such an extent that people are being massacred in Darfur, and all we can do is protest in our own streets. We can't do anything to save them.
The man Romeo Dallaire, who I know, to me, it was very telling and touching that you brought him as an example in this article, because he was here as a guest at one evening that we brought him down for before he was a senator, and the talk was very straight. And then, as you remember, when he became a senator, he said, well, the Liberal government is doing everything it can. Now, this was 2 months after he had used the toughest language about the Martin government and their lack of even verbalizing anything on Darfur. Then he switches and says, we're doing great things. Then Martin goes out and he goes the other way. Is that symptomatic of a sickness that we have in our public life in this country?
I think what it is Dallaire was working very closely with Martin on the trying to do something in Darfur. And if you recall back in May 2005, the solution they came up with was to use the African Union to try and provide some security. And Canada sent money and they sent equipment and people to help train African Union soldiers to use that equipment. Dallaire, I know from the sources I have within the Liberal government, or that Liberal government, was working very closely with Paul Martin. He's working with David Kilgore as well, to try and come up with some kind of solution. But the fact was is that we simply could do nothing in terms of sending troops over there. If you recall, there was also a question about whether our troops that were there to train African Union soldiers would be armed to protect themselves, and it ended up that they were only given handguns and walking into a war zone. So I think it's not symptomatic of our system. It's Dallaire trying to get Martin to do something, but at the end of the day, he really didn't do very much, and now Dallaire is once again speaking his mind.
Mm-hmm. As you know, Lou McKenzie, who's an advisor of the Institute and a frequent guest here, he's not really keen on an African Union troop contingent. He'd like to see the UN and even the Europeans come in. Why is Dallaire so tied to the idea of African troops?
I think initially there was a suggestion that to have troops from white countries on the ground in Black Africa with guns in their hands was seen as some sort of colonial imperialist adventure. All the sort of liberal nonsense that you get about these sort of things whenever you put people in the field to try and stop something happening, they make it into some sort of political enterprise. I think Dallaire was in some ways taken in by that. I do believe now that he thinks that sort of thing is nonsense. The African Union has failed to protect the people in Darfur. We need people on the ground who can provide security. The best people who are able to do that are from NATO countries.
John, we just have to pay some bills, but when we come back, I'm going to talk to you about another aspect of our foreign policy and that you've underlined so well and so clearly and with such candor, that rather than muscle, Canadians are always offered a myth, and we're going to talk about something that we may be able to do, but we haven't been doing. Montreal, okay. We'll be right back after this with John Turley-Yort. Very pleased to have with us John Turley-Yort, deputy editor of the National Post, on the myths in our foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
John, you talked about, in your recent piece, the whole false notions that we've been sold. Lloyd Axworthy's talk about soft power and back channels and back rooms. Now, there's one thing that we always say, or our governments always say to us, that we're out there, Canada, we're out there on humanitarian missions. Of course, 90% of the money for tsunami relief never got there, but we're out there. Now, I wanted to have on with us tonight, but he couldn't make it, then John Prendergast. Now, John Prendergast worked in Clinton's National Security Council. He was responsible for the Africa desk. 18 months ago, he takes off, leaves everything he's doing, and opens up what became the largest refugee camp on the Chad Darfur border, and is now working with the International Crisis Group out of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's one man, one guy, no organization, no government backing him.
Mm-hmm.
We have such a fidelity to this Canadian notion of peacekeeping and goody-two-shoes. Why aren't we out there building a refugee camp?
Well, I mean, quite frankly, once our government commits to doing that, it means putting in the infrastructure. It means, trying to get our NGOs in there, putting our bureaucrats on the ground. Our government isn't very good at doing that. We simply don't have the ability, the skills to do that sort of thing at all. You can see it in Afghanistan, where there's concerns about development money. For example, children in Afghanistan are in the area where the Canadians are apparently going hungry. And we have troops in that area. We are simply not up to snuff when it comes to providing people with this sort of desperate need.
We've been told we need at least 15,000 more troops to be effective on any kind of missions, humanitarian or otherwise. Do you see any chance, short of a majority Harper government, of achieving that?
No, we are probably 10 years away from having an effective military.
Wow.
In 2002, the Liberal government basically set out a policy where we would have two lines of operation in our military. That is, we'd be able to deliver two task forces anywhere around the world. The task force, it consists of 750 troops. They had a strategic reserve task force of another 450-600. Right now, we've got 2,500 troops over in Afghanistan.
Yep.
We are already maxed out. That's why the head of our military right now, our chief of defense staff, is saying we're tapped out because
right.
We built a military. He only put 2,500 people on the ground.
It's amazing to think that just 1993, when the Jiang Kai-shek administration took over, we had missions in 9 different places in the world, including in Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? My little ray of optimism is the latest circulation numbers show the National Post is going up and some of the Liberal Party at Prayer newspapers going down. So as long as we have eloquent voice like John Turley Ewerts and Jonathan Kays and the others, and they're being listened to, maybe we got a chance out of this wilderness. John, many, many thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We're going to have time for one quick call. Let's pick who it is. And Andy, you've been very patient.
Oh, I've been patient. I called in soon after 7 o'clock.
You're a sainted person.
Yeah. The thing is this. First of all, yes, three things. Yesterday's guy from Vancouver, the doctor, about Kyoto.
Yes, Tim Ball.
He's full of hot air.
Well, actually, he's not.
I'll tell you why.
Go read his stuff.
Oh, no.
You
no,
can't
no.
tell me why, because we're not going to discuss the whole environmental agenda with a minute left in the show.
The supporting the troops, it's a fantastic idea. But with the military leadership and behind that, given political leadership, political command to the military, it might as well give the troops of Canada cyanide pills.
Well,
because you cannot win. The way they're doing it, it's impossible. It's suicidal. You better change the policy or you're going to lose. And even 15,000 more troops will not do the jobs Afghanistan.
I think they'll do the job if they're given the weapons and the tools. Andy, thank you very much.
That's
up against the clock. It's always good to hear from you.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, that's about it for us. Thanks to Nick Mays and Master Control. I'll leave you with a message that I started this evening out with. We have in our lives fleeting and temporary encounters with passion. And when we find them, we've got to grab them. And we've got to grab the courage that goes with it. Because that's all we've got at the end of the days. We all die, but very few of us get to live. So let's start living, and let's start living with courage and with dignity. Good night.